For Montreal, Quebec, this is the Bar Brawl.
Welcome, Bar Brawlers, to the Coriolanus Speeches Podcast. My name is Daniel Desroux. I'm the co-host of the Bar Brawl Podcast. With me, as always, is Eric Jean, and my cat is Cuff.
Yeah, it's coming.
It's coming. For it looks like I'm going to be cleaning up something pretty soon. So if you listeners listen very carefully, you may hear disgusting cat puking noises. Mr. Eric Jean,
woohoo!
The weather is colder.
Yep.
That suits you well.
Yeah, as I move closer and closer to my wedding day.
Your skin does not sweat compassion.
No, my skin is content not to sweat.
That only works for tears, although we can use it for anything. We are going to go through Coriolanus, which if you haven't heard, you should. Go to iTunes, download the 5 podcasts where you can listen to the whole play of the tragedy of Caius Marcius Coriolanus, which if you listen to, you can count how many times I say Gaius Marcius instead of Caius Marcius.
Drinking game.
It's a drinking game. I made a few mistakes.
Oops.
Maybe I was drinking while I was reading it. Anyway, you can also go to the Bard Brawl, bardbrawl.com, and read some helpers, some Cliff's notes. We call them Eric's notes.
Oh, is that what we call them?
On each act of the play. Coriolanus, a very fun play. Mm-hmm. The speech is not easy.
No. Because there are speeches, but they're not easily capped off. It's really hard to take something out of the scene. It, in a lot of cases, it loses some of its impact or not immediately obvious.
It's very easy to compare this to Julius Caesar, and one of the main comparisons which we brought up is that Caesar is a talky play. Mm. I think I used that technical
term. It's a speechy
play. Talky.
Yeah.
Whereas this play is very action, and in particular, the first act.
Yeah.
We mentioned the movie quite a bit in this because there's really only that movie. I haven't seen this play performed.
I've seen bits of the BBC version, which
too.
I saw were very good, but they're very different staging. And
I have a feeling like this play will start to be performed after that movie because it did get received pretty well. People seem to like it, and it worked really well.
Yeah, I thought so.
It's really violent, and really Ralph Fiennes is really good. Gerard Butler's good. What's her name?
Vanessa
Redgrave
is amazing.
Really good. The first act, there's only really one speech. We found a few speeches that were all right, but we found one, sort of the introduction of Coriolanus. And Coriolanus, well, he's not Coriolanus at this time, he's just Marcius.
Marcius.
So he comes in, we've got a scene, a rabble scene. This play is littered with rabble scenes, citizens, sometimes.
Well, it's also that there's always so many people on stage at once. And like Daniel said, Julius Caesar is speeches, long, long, long speeches. People sitting quietly as they listen to people speak. Here it's dialogue, exchanges. When there are speeches, they're interrupted. It's very different. You know, Coriolanus really walks among people, whereas, you know, you've seen the movie Julius Caesar, Mark Antony standing up at the steps and the ocean of people in front of him, and he speaks for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Not
even like most of the plays, him with senators, and they all are respectful and they listen, but this one is just the masses.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have, and this, I think, speech does a good job of kind of showing what this play is all about. It's about this just unstopped tension between characters. And we have Andre Simoneau, our actor, director, writer friend, reading this scene. It comes to us in Act 1, Scene 1. Enter Caius Marcius.
Hail, noble Marcius.
Thanks. What's the matter, you dissentious rogues, that rubbing the poor itch of your opinion make yourselves scabs?
We have ever your good word.
He that will give good words to thee will flatter beneath a boring. What would you have, you curs, that like nor peace nor war? The one affrights you, the other makes you proud. He that trusts to you where he should find you lions, finds you hares. Where foxes, geese. You are no surer, no, than is the coal of fire upon the ice, or hailstone in the sun. Your virtue is to make him worthy whose offense subdues him and curse that justice did it. Who deserves greatness deserves your hate, and your affections are a sick man's appetite, who desires most that which would increase his evil. He that depends upon your favors swims with fins of lead and hews down oaks and rushes. Hang ye, trust ye. With every minute you do change a mind, and call him noble that was now your hate, him vile that was your garland. What's the matter that in these several places of the city you cry against the noble senate, who, under the gods, keep you in awe, which else would feed one on one another? What's their seeking?
For corn at their own rates, whereof they say the city is well stored.
Hang 'em, they say. They'll sit by the fire and presume to know what's done in the capital. Who's like to rise, who thrives and who declines, side factions and give out conjectural marriages, making parties strong and feebling such as stand not in their liking below their cobbled shoes. They say there's grain enough. Would the nobility lay aside their ruth and let me use my sword? I'll make a quarry with thousands of these quartered slaves as high as I could pick my lance.
So you hear in that first speech, you hear the tension between them, just in Coriolanus. The great thing about this place is you have this sort of confusion followed by a bit of a consensus. Mm-hmm. And then Coriolanus comes in and always, like, flips you. And yeah. Then you kind of start to get on Coriolanus' side. And then he takes it too far and it just becomes messy. So it's really hard to pin down who you're rooting for.
Yeah, I mean, the play really wants you, I think, right at the beginning to go, yeah, feed those commoners. They're right. Who is this jerk that, you know, doesn't give them food? And then, of course, the said jerk shows up, delivers this amazing speech about how the people haven't done anything to deserve food. And then we're thinking, well, maybe we'll see what happens with this Coriolanus guy. And then he beats a whole bunch of people single-handedly, refuses a whole bunch of rewards for his part in the fighting. And it doesn't even really want to be consul, but his mom makes him do it.
The first act is, there's a lot happens in it. We don't have a lot of speeches in it for this podcast, but listen to act one, or, well, listen to the podcast, and then the movie. Yeah. Movie's good, or the play is probably good, but I would just listen to the podcast myself.
Well, it seems like that's how Shakespeare intended it to be experienced.
There is a hunger in this play, though, that it starts with them starving. And that it's so intense in its emotion. That's kind of why I like it.
Yeah.
We're moving on. Our second is actually a conversation.
That's
not
true.
So much a speech.
Not really a speech.
It's between first officer and second officer.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout this play, we see officers and citizens and senators, and they're just 1, 2, 3, 4,
five,
I think
six, seven,
up to seven.
7 or 8, yeah, for the citizens anyways.
Yeah, I think they go up to the one scene, there's I think maybe 7 or 8 of them. Anyway, but whereas in other plays, whenever there's a citizen, they don't have a lot, but these citizens actually say something.
I think not only do they say something, but the citizens, the senators, the officers, they're Shakespeare's way of interrogating the action of the play. That you can almost imagine them as stand-ins for different opinions of people watching the actions of the play, going, well, what do you think about that? Like, well, I think Coriolanus is pretty awesome, and then someone else disagreeing.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of stages that conversation and sticks it in the play and puts these very insightful observations and remarks and these nameless characters.
You could almost even play it as if they're not in the play affecting action, but questioning the actions of the characters.
Yeah.
As if if we go back to Caesar, as if Julius Caesar would say, you know, I'm constant as a northern star, and then someone from the audience would say, but didn't you just say, and like, and have a, and it adds quite a bit to it. It adds a lot of layers to it.
Yeah.
This particular one, this one we're going to listen to is, once again, Andre and David Wheaton reading a second officer, or first officer.
Is it them again?
Oh, yes, the two of them. We have to do double duties in bar brawl often because I don't have a complete cast in my household at all times.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of characters in this play. This one is they're sort of, what are they doing?
Well, the scene is Coriolanus just conquered Corioli. They gave him the title. He came home. Everyone was really happy. And basically everyone is headed to the capital to make him consul.
Mm-hmm.
They basically want to pass the motion. And so everyone converges on that spot. And the officers are literally putting cushions on the seats for the senators to sit and debate whether or not Coriolanus should be the next consul of Rome.
Right. I bring it up, I've brought it up in the podcast a few times, when the ideas of democracy and the people's voice and whatnot are highly questionable in this play.
Yeah.
And I think this play kind of, or this conversation sort of, it sort of talks about that, how, oh, well, he's not very lovable, but a lot of people pretend to be lovable and aren't really lovable. And you can see it very contemporarily about these politicians.
You could apply that to any politician.
Yeah. Or a business leader or like public figure that you're like, yeah, he's a nice guy.
Yeah. I mean, I know he's not so popular as decisions, but maybe that's what we need.
We're just first and second officer. So here is David and Andre reading the conversation from Act 2, Scene 2.
Come, come. They're almost here. How many stand for consulships?
3, they say, but 'tis thought of every one Coriolanus would carry it.
That's a brave fellow, but he's vengeance proud and loves not the common people.
Faith, there have been many great men that have flattered the people who ne'er loved them. And there be many that have loved, they know not wherefore. So that if they love, they know not why, they hate upon no better a ground. Therefore, for Coriolanus, neither to care whether they love or hate him, manifests the true knowledge he has in their disposition, and out of his noble carelessness lets them plainly see it.
If he did not care whether he had their love or no, he waved indifferently twixt doing them neither good nor harm. But he seeks their hate with greater devotion than can render it him, and leaves nothing undone that may fully discover him their opposite. Now, to seem to affect the malice and displeasure of the people is as bad as that which he dislikes, to flatter them for their love.
He hath deserved worthily of this country, and his ascent is not by such easy degrees as those who, having been supple and courteous to the people, bonneted, without any further deed to have them at all in their estimation and report. But he hath so planted his honors in their eyes, and his actions in their hearts, that for their tongues to be silent, and not confess so much, were a kind of ingrateful injury. To report otherwise were a malice that, giving itself the lie, would pluck reproof and rebuke from every ear that heard it.
No more of him. He's a worthy man. Make way. They are coming.
So going back, we have our conspirators. I guess they're not really conspirators. When we first read this, we kind of read it in direct comparison to Caesar, being Cassius and Brutus are the conspirators. They want to take out Caesar because he's too vain and proud, and it seemed like that's the way it was going. But having like read it now 3 times and seen the movie, and the two antagonists, I guess, or what would the tribunes of the people are, Sicinius and Brutus. This is a new post that has just been established in the early Republic of Rome.
We're told in the play, in fact, that they're amongst the two of the first 5 tribunes ever in Rome.
So it's early Roman Republic. And we have a scene here with the two of them and being questioned by Menenius. Mm. Now, these 3 characters actually are really kind of vital to the play, and they're really interesting.
They kind of represent 2 types of politicians, in a sense. Like, Menenius is kind of an old guard. He's sort of, you allow him his excesses, and he's sort of a moderate. He likes to have his comforts, but he likes to sort of keep the peace. But the if Brutus and Sicinius aren't conspirators the way Cassius and Brutus, because they're not out, there's not even a pretense, a sustained pretense of the good of the people, because you see them and hear them talking to each other about, on the one hand, yeah, it's for the commoners, but on the other hand, it's they want to hold on to that little piece of the pie that they have for themselves. And later on, they play the people. They tell them, oh, yeah, remember when we did this thing? Like, you told Coriolanus that you wanted to be his buddy? Tell him that you did it only because we told you so. And so they make this politically expedient thing to try to cover their own butts.
Yeah.
But it's not, it doesn't have the drive that a Cassius and Brutus, like the existential crisis of do we do this?
Or the honesty.
I mean, Brutus is kind of the ultimate victim in the play, because he thinks he's doing it for all the right reasons.
The Caesar
he realizes,
Brutus.
Yeah, the Caesar Brutus. And he thinks he's doing it for all the right reasons, but Cassius is playing him and pulling him in, and he's sort of hiding behind Brutus's motives. But
these two are a little harder to differentiate. They're very similar.
Yeah.
But it kind of works. And going back to Menenius, the play has all of these characters who either don't care about their faults or don't care to look at them. The only ones who tend to do that are Menenius and Tullus Aufidius, who they kind of see things as they are. And this conversation is perfect for explaining that. So this is myself. I am Sicinius. Actually, I'm not even in this. It's just Brutus. And you're reading Brutus.
And I'm Brutus.
And Menenius is David Wheaton once again.
Yes.
You blame Martius for being proud?
We do it not alone, sir.
I know you can do very little alone, for your helps are many, or else your actions would grow wondrous single. Your abilities are too infant-like for doing much alone. You talk of pride. Oh, that you could turn your heads toward the napes of your necks, and make but an interior survey of your good selves. Oh, that you could.
What then, sir?
Why, then, you should discover a brace of unmeriting, proud, violent, testy magistrates, alias, fools as any in Rome.
Menenius, you are known well enough, too.
I am known to be a humorous patrician, and one that loves a cup of hot wine, with not a drop of allaying Tiber in it. The Tiber.
Yeah.
So that line, I'll just say one thing, that oh, that you could turn your eyes, or in David's version it was heads, toward the napes of your necks and make but an interior survey of your good selves. This is the whole play. Make a survey of yourself and find out who you are. And so many other characters just are not interested in doing that. Let's bring us to back to now Coriolanus. We don't even need to worry about saying Caius Martius anymore.
That's true. And actually, in this Daniel picked out that line, but the line for me in this section is the or else your actions would grow wondrous single. And single, punning on the idea of acting alone, but also as insignificant and having no power. And he's basically saying that unless you can sway public opinion and kiss people's butts, like, you can't make anything happen. You have no real power.
Yeah, without your rabble, you're nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas Coriolanus kind of...
And it does turn against them. The rabble, eventually, they're running for their homes because they don't want to get...
Are we going back to Coriolanus here?
Yeah,
what's our next
so.
Speech here?
Yeah. Act 3, Scene 1, except I'm pinch hitting for Andre Simino.
And I'm sure you're really upset to have to...
It's objective. It pains me to have to
You did it for the
speech.
Team. So we're going to go back to... Yeah, Andre Simino was absent for Act 3. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, I should mention that the other characters that have been introduced to, the key ones are Volumnia, I would say, and... Tullus Aufidius, although he hasn't said very much yet.
No, but we'll get to a good Tullus Aufidius moment later.
Yeah, and Volumnia has some great introduction. Yeah. She gets better as they come along, but she is very important. So, Act 3, Scene 1. Is it Act 3, Scene 1? What are we listening to?
Act 3, Scene 1. This is Coriolanus. The patricians have all decided Coriolanus should be consul, and... Coriolanus is basically presenting himself to get to accept his honor, and the tribunes sort of provoke him into admitting how much he hates the common people, and they're trying to, basically they've laid a trap for him, and they're trying to get him to sort of hang himself through his words and his actions so that he can't be consul.
And this is a Plutarch, this is straight out of Plutarch, where Plutarch writes, Plutarch is the source text for this play, writes that they know that he will either be himself and go crazy, or just do what they want.
Yeah, and they win either way, but
yeah,
they were hoping for this result.
So let's listen to Mr. Eric Jean taking his swing at Coriolanus. By the way, feel free to leave a comment at barbrawl.com as to which Coriolanus you prefer.
I'm going to put the first comment, and I'm voting for Andre.
No, you do a very good job. Here he is.
It is a mind that shall remain a poison where it is, not poison any further.
Shall remain. Hear you, this triton of the minnows. Mark you, his absolute shall.
Twas from the cannon. Sorry, that was Cominius. My bad. Go ahead.
Twas from the cannon.
Thank you.
Shall? Oh, good but most unwise patricians. Why, you gave but reckless senators. Have you thus given Hydra here to choose an officer that with his peremptory shall, being but the horn and noise of the monster, wants not the spirit to say he'll turn your current in a ditch and make your channel his? If you have power, then veil your ignorance. If not, awake your dangerous lenity. If you are learned, be not as common fools. And if you are not, let them have cushions by you. You are plebeians if they be senators, and they are no less when both your voices blended, the greatest taste most palates theirs. They choose their magistrate, and such a one is he who puts his shall, his popular shall, against a graver bench that ever frowned in Greece. By Jove himself it makes the consuls base, and my soul aches to know when two authorities are up, neither supreme, how soon confusion may enter twixt the gap of both, take the one by the other.
Well, on to the marketplace.
Ooh, intense, Eric. You had the intensity there. And I screwed up my line. Mm. One of the many times someone screws up their line. I'm not the only one who does it. Other people mess up their lines, too.
I provided just two examples of not getting the lines exactly right.
There is a good line right before that where the first senator, played by Benny Hedley, now in Germany, says, no more words, we beseech you. And this is like generally how this play works. It's like anyone who is sort of sympathetic for Coriolanus, including the audience, including we watching, just want him to be quiet and not lose it, but you know he's going to, which is why he's such a difficult lead character. He's like Hamlet, when Hamlet's berating Ophelia, or when he's getting all arrogant. Like, you just want him to stop talking. Like, yeah, we know you're right, but you don't have to say it.
Yeah. Say it once and then move on.
Think it, Coriolanus. Don't say it. And this one here, like he's just breaking apart these lofty ideals of the Roman Republic.
Yeah.
And you get the feeling, I know when I studied Roman history, how the teachers sort of have this idea that the Roman Republic is the ideal, right? Mm-hmm. And then it gets ruined when the emperors come along. But the Roman Republic is just this rabbly, crazy place. Yeah. And when he says, he's talking about you plebeians, if they be senators, and they are no less, when both your voices blended, the greats taste their palates theirs. Mm-hmm. It's all confused.
Well, yeah, and he's saying that if the vast majority of people are commoners, you blend everything together, you'll be ruled by commoners. They'll have, and that really wasn't the Roman Republic. The Roman Republic, like, yeah, okay, you had representation, but it wasn't this great golden age of democracy where, that's not how it worked. It was not as free as, maybe we'd like to think. And we're looking at this from a lens of, well, of course they're going to have differences of opinion, and of course there'll be consensus, and they're basically saying that's a stupid way to run a country.
Yeah.
That's Coriolanus' position, right?
This isn't working.
This isn't working. It's just that one dude make the decisions.
But then again, you don't really want Coriolanus making all the decisions because he has no temperance.
I'd want Coriolanus' mother to make the decisions. I think she'd be a, she'd make a good
politician. Are we coming up on Volumnia here? I know you've been waiting patiently for her to come up. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you why, because Eric likes reading Volumnia. That's why he's always
wanting. Oh, is that
me too? I think it's you. So, Coriolanus, based on his spazziness and his ability to be read by everybody else and used by everybody else, his basic character that he's strong, he's powerful, he can fight, but everybody knows what he's going to do, except in battle. And his main foe in battle is Tullus Aufidius, who we've talked about how much, well, I've talked about how much I like him. In this play, him and Menenius in particular, and how the two of them, they see things for what they are, but neither of them really, they're just not quite as powerful enough to take over the play.
Well, Aufidius says it. He's fought, when they first beat, he's like, I fought you about five, six times, and it didn't go so well. And then when he loses after that first, that latest fight, he says, well, damn it, screw this. I'm done with being honorable. I'm going to cheat to beat this guy. Like, that's the first real thing he says that we're listening to that isn't just a taunt to someone. He's like, I'm going to start cheating because playing by the rules, I can't compete with Coriolanus.
And in the, and so what had happened plot-wise, and you can listen to Act 3, there's a lot of stuff going on in Act 3. Yeah. Eventually, Coriolanus gets exiled. And he says,
there is a world elsewhere.
There's a world elsewhere. So those of us who are exiled, there is a world elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's a different context in this play, but he decides out of spite to try to join, to go join Tullus Aufidius, his former enemy. And the play sort of shifts here because we lose, of course, Sicinius and Brutus as these Roman. It becomes very interesting. How do you join your enemy to fight your former self who just out of spite?
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's the whole thing, right? Coriolanus just abandons himself to the role of, I think one of the most interesting things I read about it is that he's going to out-Roman Rome by conquering it. Mm-hmm. He's going to be the ultimate Roman by conquering Rome. And that's the only thing he can do at this point is to go, I see your Rome, I'll raise you one. Like,
yeah, I am Rome.
Yeah.
So when Menenius early in the play describes Rome as this body and all these parts being of this body, and I guess Coriolanus is the head or the arm or whatever.
I don't know.
And the plebeians are the stomach and all that because they're always hungry. Now he just cuts off his head and decides to fight his body. And it's here where we see Tullus Aufidius looking at Tullus Aufidius, also played by David Wheaton.
Yeah. We should point out, actually, at this moment, Coriolanus has joined with Aufidius, and Coriolanus is starting to become just a little more popular with the people and the troops than Aufidius is comfortable with.
Classic.
And so Aufidius now has talked with his lieutenants, and he's looking at the situation. And, I mean, he's sort of giving us his assessment of Coriolanus. Who is this guy? What's going to do him in, ultimately?
This play is a lot like the Vancouver Canucks in the late 90s, when we brought over Marc Messier, the one who beat us in 94 in the Stanley Cup Finals. And then he became our captain and ruined our team. I can't believe
it. Wow, that's fake.
It's all, and
that's it. We're movie adaptation right here. Coriolanus.
Coriolanus and Marc Messier.
Marc Messier, Coriolanus. I don't know.
We just got about 100 new followers from Rangers Nations and Canuck Nation. So here is Mr. David Wheaton once again as Aufidius, realizing the kid he always wanted on his team might be more popular than he is, and he's losing his team.
Think you he'll carry Rome?
All places yield to him ere he sits down, and the nobility of Rome are his.
The senators and patricians love him too. The tribunes are no soldiers, and their people will be as rash in the repeal as hasty to expel him thence. I think he'll be to Rome as is the osprey to the fish, who takes it by sovereignty of nature. First he was a noble servant to them, but he could not carry his honors even. Whether it was pride, which out of daily fortune ever taints the happy man, whether defect of judgment to fail in the disposing of those chances which he was lord of, or whether nature, not to be the other one than one thing, not moving from the cast to the cushion, but commanding peace even with the same austerity and garb as he controlled the war, but one of these, as he hath spices of them all, not all, for I dare so far free him, made him feared, so hated, and so banished. But he has a merit to choke it in the utterance, so our virtues lie in the interpretation of the time, and power unto itself most commendable, hath not a tomb so evident as a chair to extol what it hath done. One fire drives out one fire, one nail, one nail. Rights by rights fouler, strengths by strengths do fail. Come, let's away. When Caius, Rome is thine, thou art poorest of all, then shortly art thou mine.
Ooh, exit.
Coriolanus winds up, the two of them wind up right at the gates of Rome. They're about ready to conquer Rome. Mm-hmm. And then what happens?
All the desperate Romans throw Cominius at him. He shoots him down.
Menenius,
he shoots him down. And then finally, the ladies, his mother, wife, and their family friend, I guess, show up.
They bring the girls. Menenius scene, I'll just mention again. I know I talk about him a lot, but I really liked what they did with him in the movie. Mm. In the movie, he commits suicide after he leaves.
Yeah.
He has a great leave line.
But he actually comes back in the play.
Yeah, which in the play, when he comes back, and I forgot that he came back, and in the recording,
yeah.
You'll hear
it's
me.
It's a great line, though.
He comes in, he talks with Coriolanus, and he pleads with him, and then Coriolanus says, no, I don't care, I'm not going to listen to you. And Menenius says, I neither care for the world nor your general, this is to a watch. For such things as you are, I can scarce think there's any, you are so slight. He that hath a will to die by himself fears it not from another. Let your general do his worst for you, be that you are long and your misery increase with your age. I say to you, as I was said to, away. So, and it just, that ending is nice, and then he comes back and it kind of...
But yeah, it was a good decision on the in the movie.
Really like that. But then, here come the girls, and you are reading Volumnia. This is her chunky speech.
Yeah.
This is... One of my favorite themes of this play is the idea of names.
Yeah, me too.
Throughout, we have at the beginning we have him being named after a father he's never known. His father died. Volumnia, this whole big deal, and it's more his mother that's making a deal about when he conquers Coriola, he becomes Coriolanus, and it's his name, and that sort of is.
Yeah. Well, the name means not only literally the name, but the reputation, your sort of mark on history.
Yeah. Your conqueror of... and then Aphidius says he will burn his name. Or what is it? No, it's Cominius who says.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's talking about the meeting he had with Coriolanus, and he's telling the patricians and the tribunes that that Coriolanus... only once sort of responded to his name and otherwise said he swore them off until he had the chance to make himself a new one by burning down Rome.
Yeah. So if Rome, this is the interesting thing about this, if Coriolanus, well, he's not Coriolanus anymore because he's been banished,
yeah.
And so that name means nothing.
But
he's still Coriolanus. If he conquers Rome, then is his name Rome from here on in. So this is where it becomes really interesting. That
well, and the, after all this stuff, in the last scene, they finally broker the peace, and he comes back to Antium, because he said, okay, I'm your soldier now. And he is called Martius again by Aphidius. And he says, do you think I would honor you with that stolen name here in Antium? And then they jump on him and they kill him. So, yeah. Like, it's sort of a weird thing. It goes full circle. In the end, he ends up with the very name that he had right at the beginning.
What is in a name? Apparently everything. And here we have Volumnia, read by one and only Mr. Eric Jean yourself.
Myself.
You may not be able to tell because he's reading a woman's character. And I believe you put on the air of a woman. Did you not?
Yes.
In spirit.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like a woman. It just sounds like a high
man.
So here we have, this is from Act 5, Scene 3. It's a chunky one.
Yeah.
I have sat too long.
Rises.
Nay, go not from us thus. If it were so that our request did tend to save the Romans, thereby to destroy the Volsces who you serve, you might condemn us as poisonous to your honor. No, our suit is that you reconcile them. While the Volsces may say, this mercy we have showed, the Romans, this we received, and each and either side give thee all hail to thee and cry, be blessed for making us this peace. Thou knowest, great son, the end of war's uncertain, but this is certain, that if thou conquer Rome, the benefit which thou shalt thereby reap is such a name whose repetition will be dogged with curses, whose chronicle thus writ, the man was noble, but with his last attempt he wiped it out, destroyed his country, and his name remains to the ensuing age abhorred. Speak to me, son, thou hast affected the fine strains of honor to imitate the graces of the gods, to tear with thunder the wide cheeks of the air, and yet to charge thy sulphur with a bolt that should but rive an oak. Why dost thou not speak? Thinkest thou it honorable for a noble man to still remember wrongs? Daughter, speak you. He cares not for your weeping. Speak thou, boy. Perhaps thy childness will move him more than can our reasons. There's no man in the world more bound to his mother, yet he lets me prate like one of the stocks. Thou hast never in thy life showed thy dear mother any courtesy, when she, poor hen, fond of no second brood, was clucked thee to the wars and safely home, loaded with honor. Say my requests unjust, and spurn me back. If it be not so, thou art not honest, and the gods will plague thee, that thou restrained from me the duty which to a mother's part belongs. He turns away. Down, ladies, let us shame him with our knees. To his surname Coriolanus longs more pride than pity to our prayers. Down, an end, this is the last, so we will home to Rome, and die among our neighbors. Nay, behold, this boy that cannot tell what he would have, but kneels and holds up hands for fellowship, does reason our petition with more strength than thou hast to deny it. Come, let us go. This fellow has a Volscian to his mother. His wife is in Coriola, and his child like him by chance. It give us our dispatch. I am hushed until our city be afire. Then I'll speak a little.
Coriolanus holds her by the hand, silent.
Oh, mother, mother, what have you done? Behold, the heavens do ope. The gods look down, and this unnatural scene they laugh at. Oh, my mother, mother, oh, you have won a happy victory to Rome. But for your son, believe it, oh, believe it, most dangerously you have with him prevailed, if not most mortal to him. But let it come.
So we'll leave it there. There's a ton of speeches in this, and I do recommend that you listen to them all.
Over and over again.
and particularly in the film, to watch the Vanessa Redgrave as Volumnia in this scene, and
so
her
good.
Pleading with him, and Ralph Fiennes does a really good job of it. But this scene, kind of, we've been leading up to one of her speeches, and it shows just how she's able to play on his honor. In the end, his honor does matter.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why he's so single-minded, is because it's his, he believes in honor.
Yeah.
And
it's a point of honor for him not to lie to the people.
Right.
Not to pretend to be something else, not to misrepresent himself.
And so, yeah, he can be spiteful, but he can't kill himself. Actually, that's an interesting point, because there's nothing noble in his death in this play. He just kind of gets jumped when he goes back to the Volscians.
It's really awful.
It's really kind of nasty. They sort of surround him and just start stabbing him.
Well, I remember we were saying before that the senator's telling him, like, listen, shut up, dude. Like, shut up, stop talking. And the irony is that Aphidius wants to kill him before he has a chance to speak, because he's afraid that once he can speak, he'll be able to talk his way out of it, which is a really weird, I mean, a sort of a weird switch on that.
Well, I think situation. Because he's really a Volscian. I think because Coriolanus acts like a Volscian, and those are his people. Like, once he's there, everybody supports him. In Rome, you have to play politics, you have to dance a bit, you have to lie, you have to kind of not be yourself sometimes. Where the Volscians, you never see them having the same sort of discussion. They just are like, oh, he's strongest, I'll go with him.
Well, there's a funny thing, too. I noticed in some of the different traditions, the people standing guard outside the camp are sometimes written as first soldier, but sometimes written as first senator.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, you can't imagine... Can you really imagine Menenius, like, strapping on his armor and, like, charging to battle? No.
It'd be very, like, Falstaff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He actually reminds me, his description of himself, he really reminds me of Falstaff a little bit.
Not as funny, but...
No, and not as fat, but...
Not many funny characters in this.
Well, the serving people that Tullus Aphidius's house, they're the only really funny characters.
Ah, yeah, and David Wheaton and Andre in particular tend to...
Act 4, go check it out. It's
it's quite something, and next play we're going to do is going to be very different, but I will let you just wonder what that is. Next time, we're going to come back and we're going to do a sonnet podcast, our first sonnet podcast.
Exciting.
So this is exciting. We'll go through the first 5 sonnets, do readings of them. I hope you have enjoyed the bonus sonnets that are at the end of each of these podcasts. They're read by a number of lovely ladies.
Mm-hmm.
All ladies.
Switch that up at some point. But it needs to be irregular sort of cast people, you know? Like, that's sort of the nice thing. But
yeah, and we talk a lot. So yeah, it's good to have a different one. I'm not reading sonnets. So we're going to go over some sonnets. So all of you university students who have had the headache of having to dissect a Shakespearean sonnet for an essay or something, you can listen to it. Feel free to footnote us. Check the
proper Emily
proper
style.
Proper Emily style for footnoting for podcasts. But yeah, I encourage you all to... The dream of my life is to see a student get busted for plagiarism.
Plagiarizing one of our blog posts.
Oh, that would be the dream of my life. Or just plagiarizing the podcast itself. That would be great. So please come back. We will see you, we will speak at you shortly. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Sonnet 11. As fast as thou shalt wane, so fast thou growest, in one of thine from that which thou departest. And that fresh blood which youngly thou bestowest, thou mayest call thine when thou from youth convertest. Herein lives wisdom, beauty, and increase. Without this, folly, age, and cold decay. If all were minded so, the times should cease, and their score year would make the world away. Let those whom nature hath not made for store, harsh, featureless, and rude, barrenly perish. Look whom she best endowed, she gave the more, which bounteous gift thou shouldest in bounty cherish. She carved thee for her seal and meant thereby, thou shouldest print more, not let that copy die.